From KHOI in Story City, Ames, I'm Chris Viviora, and this is Book Central, the show that interviews authors from the Central Time Zone. My guest today is Caroline Bureau, author of the new memoir, Tell Me Exactly What Happened. That chronicles her more than 10 years as a dispatcher in White Bear, Minnesota. Caroline dials into the busyness and boredom of conversing about crime and medical emergencies. Caroline has also worked as a journalist and technical writer before and after dispatching. Caroline Bureau, welcome to Book Central.
Thanks for having me.
Caroline, in your first book, Answering 911, you recounted the rookie experience of dispatching, and in the second book, you start at the tail end of your work with the police department and then continue into your 8 years as a medical dispatcher. Why did you shift from working with the police to medical emergencies?
When I was working, the last department I worked for was a single dispatcher dispatch center, and you can imagine that that's pretty stressful. And everything fell to one person, so that if a 911 call came in and multiple things needed to happen for that call, you're just one person, and I felt sometimes just powerless to do things quickly enough. And one of the things that I really wanted to do more of was what is called pre-arrival instructions, which is when you're able to talk callers through, sometimes if they need help with CPR or the Heimlich maneuver or delivering a baby, stuff like that. And I really wanted to be able to do that for my callers. And I knew I would never really be able to in a single person dispatch center, because there's just too much that you have to do. So I switched and went to a private ambulance company where I could do that more regularly and without interruption. I could just help the callers through those first important minutes before actual first responders arrive. Or I shouldn't say actual first responders, because we're the actual first responders, but before someone physically arrives on scene.
Sure. And what were other differences of being alone versus being with a group from police to medical that you were able to get away with or get into? And I don't mean getting away with that you did something that you weren't allowed to, but that you didn't have to do anymore.
Well, when I switched from the police dispatch center to the medical dispatch center, that makes it a secondary calling point. So I didn't actually have to get the first call, as in the confusing first moments of a call where you don't know what the address is and all of those things. So I was actually getting calls transferred to me from the police departments and saying, here's the address, here's the problem, now talk this person through the medical.
And during this process, you kind of shifted from being a rookie to a veteran. And I found that really interesting that this was the follow-up book to another book that you've written. In Tell Me Exactly What Happened, you had a coworker named Stella, and you had a lot of coworkers who had been lifers, who were veterans. But yeah. Stella in particular, she had once answered a call about a nearby tornado, and she dispatched for 2 straight hours. I can't imagine just focused in that moment. Yeah. Did you ever have any of that kind of automatic response in the zone type situations where you felt, oh, this is my crossover from being a rookie to a veteran?
Yeah, in small ways. You know, there were times when I would get off the phone with a shooting victim or a suicide or something, and I would look back at it and go, I did what I was supposed to do there, and I didn't have to really even think about it. And I would say probably when I started, it sounds terrible, but when I started forgetting all the details, I would come home from work and my family members would ask, what was your day like? And I wouldn't really always remember, because it started rolling off me in a way. I don't think you can say that completely, but at least I wasn't freaking out about every single thing, you know?
Right. Maybe that it
wasn't so traumatic anymore.
And maybe that it pushes beneath your subconscious, that it's not something that you have to deal with in the present, but it kind of stacks up underneath.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me exactly what happened. You admit to being a former addict, and you write about how that destruction of your life to get high paralleled the feeling of saving a life while dispatching. Was there a part of you that felt like dispatching was a way to redeem yourself? Were there other dispatchers who had that kind of background who kind of wanted to make good on their life?
No, you don't find a lot of people in recovery in emergency services. I was kind of alone in that respect, or at least as far as I knew.
Mm-hmm.
As far as redeeming myself, my redeeming myself always has come in the form of being present for my family. I didn't feel I needed to redeem myself by going into a profession like dispatching. For me, dispatching was, at first it was a major curiosity, and then it was, holy crap, I'm here. I might as well try and do this and do it well. And then it became a point of pride once I got through that rookie stage where it was like, wow, I'm helping people and I'm doing good work. Mm-hmm. So, but I never felt, you know, I need to redeem myself with the public at large.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your first book's subtitle was Life in the Hot Seat. And I wondered, towards the end of the trajectory of dispatching, that you had to face whether or not shifting from being a rookie to a veteran, but then a veteran to a lifer, that this is something mm-hmm. that you might have to do for 30 years or more. And that seems really daunting. So did that hot seat eventually cool for you?
Not entirely. I think if it has entirely, then you're probably being too complacent. I think if you're spending all of your dispatching with your feet up on the console, then you're probably way too casual about it. I really had to have a hard look at whether I wanted to be a lifer. And obviously in the end I chose not to, because and I could only make this decision for myself. I think I worked with a lot of people who were lifers with grace and poise and just kept on doing good work the whole time.
Mm.
And I saw some who I didn't feel that way about.
Sure.
And I saw myself going in the direction of maybe not being as productive in the future. And I was exhausted all the time. And I had no guarantee, you know, if you get on board with a dispatch center, you're at the low end of the seniority. And so you're kind of at their mercy as far as what hours you work.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the place, you still are at their mercy for the first like 10, 15 years. And I saw people who were there 20 years who still weren't really getting very healthy work schedules. And I couldn't see working nights anymore. I just physically was so spent on that. And, you know, because I have addiction in my history, I also have depression in my history.
Mm.
And so there were days that felt so incredibly low. And I talk about it in the very first part of the book, how low I could get if I had to be sleep deprived in between shifts and then try and go in for another shift. And the terror of knowing I'm going in for a 12-hour shift on 4 hours of sleep. And who am I going to fail? Am I going to fail someone,
mm-hmm.
you know? And who's that going to be? And so that was a heavy weight to carry. And while I miss the work, I don't miss that feeling at all.
Mm. And it's almost like you never get to leave, except maybe on those 2 days off between the 4 days on.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was wonderful to have, you know, when you have a schedule where you work 12-hour shifts, then you end up with, you know, 4 or 5 days off at a time, which, mm-hmm. was terrific, and I miss some days a lot. You know, when I work Monday through Friday now, and it's like, oh, I only have 2 days off. But yeah, during those 4 days when you're working, you know, the 12-hour night shifts and whatever, you're kind of in hell. You're kind of in, like, nothing else is going on, you know. You can't really schedule anything else.
You're doing time. I mean, you're there even when you're not there. And I wondered that dispatchers don't always know the resolution of a call. There's lots of moments in your book that we might only get the start of something before you hand it off. And I wondered if writing the memoir was a catharsis from your dispatching, maybe a way to deal with the memories of the calls, to get some kind of resolution or at least write them down.
Yeah, well, writing has always been a sort of a therapy for me. If I had to live through something that was hard, to be able to write something about it that's healing and that gives me some perspective on it, that's a pretty awesome thing just for me personally. And then if someone reads it and says, wow, I really related to that, then that's like, you know, it gives back to you again. Yeah, I would say, you know, writing just helped a lot with dealing with the stress while I was there and even after.
And so with writing it, that it releases you from the stress. Another thing that you mentioned in the book is that you practice a lot of yoga, which is interesting because any kind of meditation or form like that is about being present in the moment. There is no past. You don't consider the future. And it seems like such a parallel to dispatching, that you have to be in the zone if you're truly going to make life happen or save life.
And, that's a good point.
And so how did your yoga practice fold into dispatching? And you still do yoga, obviously. I'm assuming, actually. But how did yoga fold into your dispatching?
Well, for me, it was like I would, you know, go in and work a shift and be listening to 10 or 15 different things simultaneously all night long in various ways, and, you know, yelling and squelches and just all this constant noise going on. And so yoga was like the anti-dispatch center. I mean, if I would go to a yoga class, it's like, I have one job and it is to be in child's pose. <You know? laughs> I don't have to be doing anything else or listening to anything else. And, you know, frankly, and I had a yoga instructor who was also a good friend tell me, you know, you can just go into yoga and lay on your back the whole time. I was like, well, that's awesome. But not that I did a lot of that, because I figure if I paid, you know, $15 to be in a yoga class, I was going to do something. But it just was, if all you have to focus on is one thing, that is such a relief after being responsible for so many things coming at you all the time.
Well, we're going to take a short break here. You're listening to Book Central. Everything I do in slow motion. I don't know what to say. Everywhere I fall, don't know name or location. Maybe I'll just run away. I'll find it.
Thank you. day. Everywhere I fall, don't know name or location. Baby, I just find my way. I find it heavy as my sleep, and now it's my dreaming. Oh, you're pretty through the night. And you may taste the salt that rolls off my cheekbone, but you don't know why I cry.
Support for this program is provided by Plot Twist Bookstore in Ankeny, a place where book lovers can browse, talk, and meet. Open daily. For hours and more information, go to plottwistbookstore.com. We're back. If you're just joining me today, my guest is Caroline Bureau, author of the new memoir, Tell Me Exactly What Happened, from the Minnesota Historical Society Press. Caroline worked for more than a decade as a dispatcher. Before the break, we were talking about her shift from police to medical dispatching and what makes a veteran out of a rookie, and how do you deal with going from being a veteran or not into becoming a lifer. Caroline, many of the conversations that you recount in the book with callers seem ridiculous, but some of that has to do with miscommunication, or rather, it's difficult over the phone to convey complete communication, especially in emergency situations. Would you share the notorious psychology study that explains this disconnect, and maybe even recount a story or two about what you heard or what you said that wasn't exactly what was heard or said?
Sure. Well, I talk about a study out of California that's a few decades old now, I believe. The gist of it is that words are only a very small part of communication. Tone and body language are a very important part of communication. And the point of bringing that up in the book was just to say how very much that the dispatcher doesn't get with the phone call. And, one thing, now that we're talking about texting by, getting texts.
Oh, man.
To 911, that breaks it down to even less to go on, really. I'm kind of glad I never fielded a texted 911 call because, I mean, there's just so many ways to misconstrue information. And so.
Sure. Like someone could say, like, he's killing me. And it's not really, a murder. It's just like being irritated by someone.
It made me laugh. Yeah. Well, and I don't think anyone would call 911 to say, he's making me laugh. But, there's just so many different ways that we say things. And basically, a dispatcher on the phone with someone is getting about half of what a person can actually communicate. And so oftentimes we are trying to decipher, is this person really in a panic or just running or, what's actually going on?
And so, then what are some of the, you definitely had sides on both of the mic and then also, listening in where there were miscommunications. What were some of those that occurred?
I talk about a point in the book where a gentleman called me from a plant and said, a manufacturing plant. He said, so I had a whiff of ammonia, and I understood later that I thought I heard pneumonia to start with. And he was kind of trying to downplay the situation because it was a really big deal that ammonia had, they had some ammonia problems and it was a little bit out of control. And I think he was trying to downplay that piece of it. Mm-hmm. With his tone. So I heard pneumonia and I dispatched for a guy with pneumonia and my officer arrived. And of course it was, way more serious than that. way more dangerous than he had thought. And that officer almost was injured. Well, he did have to go and be seen because he had some symptoms, but he ended up being okay. But I felt awful. I mean, I felt just awful that my initial mistake, my mishearing and misreading of the situation almost put him in very bad danger.
Mm. And then there's some humorous moments, too. They're not all necessarily difference between an illness and a chemical leak that you've had occur.
Yes. Well, there's actually, I'm thinking of something that maybe is a little too strong for this.
You can go ahead. Yeah.
Well, there's some backstory to a situation that I describe. Had to do with a gentleman who called in who was having sex with his girlfriend and very calmly called me and said, well, we were having sex and I heard something snap.
Not a noise you ever want to hear.
Right, I would assume not. And he had done something very serious to himself, but was calm as could be. Now, when I got his girlfriend on the phone, that was a different deal.
Mm.
She was pretty hysterical, but
a funny way, in a freaked out way.
Yeah, right. She wasn't laughing. It was a serious injury, but it was apparently not the first time he'd had that kind of injury.
Oh, man.
And I tried. You know, we have no control over who we send as far as paramedics. We just send the closest truck.
Mm.
And the backstory to that call is that I looked at my closest truck and saw that there were two women on that truck. And I really wanted to send him a couple of guys, you know, for his sake. But I had to send him two women. But, you know, he didn't seem all that embarrassed, so I guess.
It happened before.
Well, yeah.
And so, you know, you have a lot of great relationships with emergency medical people and police officers. And there's one police officer in particular that you know. And I don't know if it was when you first got started, but he talked to you about the importance of downtime, a.k.a. donut time, where it seems like emergency workers aren't really working. But can you tell us a little bit, how does downtime actually function?
Yeah, you know, in between emergency services, it feels like it's feast or famine quite a bit. And so you'll have an hour or so where it's just nonstop calls rolling in. And they're not necessarily all emergencies, but everyone's up and about. Everyone's doing stuff out in the world and things are happening. And the dispatch center is very busy. And then there are hours, and usually, not always, but usually they're in the middle of the night where nothing's happening. But you have to be alert. You can't fall asleep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So downtime, you know, it's a debate everywhere you go between dispatch centers or between management and dispatchers. Like, what should dispatchers be allowed to do during downtime? Should they be able to have a TV?
Mm.
Should they be able to bring in their personal computers? I mean, we all have personal computers in our pockets, technically, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be allowed to be doing certain things, you know, while at work? And it's a debate that happens constantly. And I err on the side of you need to be able to stay awake.
Mm-hmm.
Reading articles on Huffington Post or whatever keep you awake, then I think that's a good thing.
Hmm.
But it does get destructive when people get so engaged in what they're doing or what they're reading that they don't hear what's going on in the room,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. And you kind of had that happen.
Definitely. I wasn't getting enough sleep, and I was bringing in my laptop to look at during downtime. And a coworker said to me, "You're missing stuff," and I didn't realize it. It was during a period where I was sometimes only getting four or five hours before my next shift of sleep.
Wow.
And that wasn't sufficient. And so, you know, there were things going on in the room that would buzz right past me because I was in a fog. And having the computer didn't help. It just actually seemed to make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
So, but frankly, getting reprimanded by one of your coworkers is a pretty big wake-up call.
Sure.
And that kept me going for quite a while because you don't want to let your partners down. That is a big thing. There is a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of infighting and griping and family stuff, but I didn't want to let my coworkers down. That was a terrible feeling.
It's almost, you know, like being in a platoon or something.
Yeah, yeah. You're fighting a little war of your own. And certainly dispatchers feel a little disenfranchised, you know, like nobody understands us.
Right.
And so we're protective of each other for the most part.
And speaking of more miscommunications or misconceptions, sometimes dispatchers aren't understood because of the perceptions out there of dispatchers. And you write about how certain TV shows inaccurately depict emergency work. How did that kind of perception of your job interfere with doing your job as a dispatcher?
Well, I don't think dispatchers think a lot about how they're perceived on a day-to-day basis. But it does hurt to only be seen in a certain way. And, you know, I remember I dispatched, a lady called one day and said, "Oh, my God, I'm watching this kid drive away in my car."
Mm-hmm.
And I knew exactly who was close to the situation. I dispatched that officer. It was really, really slick, if I do say so myself. And and they caught up with the kid and the car, and all ended well. And she came down to the police department and she was just beaming. She was so happy to have her car back. And I was happy to see her. And she's like, "I really want to talk to that officer because he did such a great job." And I was like, you know.
I was the one who did the good job, right?
Yeah, well, he did a fantastic job, but I did too. And so, what was the point of that?
Well, Caroline, maybe it's like you're the person who writes the directions and, you know, the police officers many times are the ones who follow them. But if there were no directions or instructions, then they wouldn't be able to do an efficient job.
Yeah, yeah, a good dispatcher is invaluable, and most officers and paramedics know that. You know, I would say that I never felt a shortage of appreciation from police officers and medics. Some thank us more than others, but they seem to understand. You know, and it was always super appreciated when someone would come back to the dispatch center and go, "Yeah, you know that call involving the six-year-old, well, he's going to be okay, or he's not okay, or whatever," you know, and give us that closure that we almost wouldn't get any other way, you know.
So there are some popular culture perceptions of dispatchers, some maybe even misconceived dispatchers as active heroes. You write that that you've never met anyone that you saved, but you've definitely heard about the closure of these situations. However, there's one movie that you and your fellow dispatchers talk about. How does that movie shape the perception of being a dispatcher? Tell us a little bit about that movie.
The Call, starring Halle Berry? I don't know. She plays I believe it's a Los Angeles dispatcher, and she is absolutely the hero of this story. And, you know, she has the typical hero arc, and, you know, she has the rise and fall and then the rise again. at the very end. It's a bit cheesy, and especially the end is really hard to believe. And the end just goes completely off the rails. But I talk about it in the book. I really appreciated the movie just for being a movie about a dispatcher and not a movie about a cop. And then there's a dispatcher over there, it's part of why I write these books, because no one else is writing them, no one else is writing from the perspective of a dispatcher. And I think it's a void, So I liked how she was the hero. I liked how they did touch on the stress and the weight of the job and what a heavy thing that is. Because, initially she takes a call where, in hindsight, she realizes she did something that made a mistake, that it was a mistake for the caller. But she had zero time to think about it, And that is what it's like to be a dispatcher. You can talk about a call afterward and go, oh, well, you should have asked this, or you should have said that. And it's like, yes, you're probably right, but I had no time to think about it. And no other call was like that call.
In the moment, you had to deal with what you had.
Yeah.
In your own life, you've got your husband, Jim, who writes screenplays, but also he dispatched. Did you feel like you had an empathetic partner there, or did you still end up having misconceptions about each other's work, both dispatching and writing?
We definitely were able to relate to what each other were going through. I think the hard thing about having two people trying to have a household and raise a child while both doing that job is that you're both like, well, what? I have to work, Yeah, I know it's a terrible day to work. I know, we're going to miss Christmas, but sorry. Mm. And so it was hard for both of us to have that responsibility. There were probably a couple Christmases where my daughter felt like she didn't really get a Christmas, So it was both good and bad for that. And I talk about this in the book too, that poor Mariah, like when it came to being allowed to do things, if there were any, if there was any possibility of her being injured or being around the wrong person or, being kidnapped or, which when you dispatch, you think that happens all the time, mm-hmm. And we would just grill her about every single thing she wanted to do. And it was like, I'm sure. And later she told us, she was like, God, you guys, everything, the world isn't such a terrible place. But, no one called us to tell us when they'd had a good day, So we were just like, no, the world is a terrible place and you're not going out in it.
But then she did end up having an emergency situation.
She did. Yeah. She, when she was 16 and she had only been driving 3 weeks, she had a very serious car accident about 5 minutes from our house. And I got a phone call. I knew she had just left the house, and I got a phone call from some guy I didn't know, and he said, are you Mariah's mom? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, your daughter's been in an accident. There's a little blood, but she's okay. And I can hear her screaming. So my husband and I, drove to the accident, and it was the worst thing either of us had ever seen, And I don't see a lot of accidents. I hear them, but it was horrendous. And they had to, peel her out of the car like a little tuna, So I got to see the whole game from a different perspective, from the perspective of needing the help.
Yeah, that you definitely saw the flip side of emergency services. It was almost mm-hmm. like validation of your job, that there are people who help everyday families, and sometimes it's the emergency workers who are those everyday families.
Yeah. And then I can't imagine what the dispatcher went through, because this happened in the community where it's a single person dispatch center. And I imagine that that poor dispatcher got 50 cell phone calls about that accident.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I thank her in the book because that's a nightmare call for a single person dispatch center, because she had to get probably three or four different resources going for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
She had to dispatch ambulance, police, fire, and a helicopter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take another short break here. You're listening to Book Central. This program is supported by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The views and opinions expressed by this program do not necessarily reflect those of Humanities Iowa or the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're back. Before the break, I was talking to my guest, Caroline Bureau, about the miscommunications and misconceptions of dispatching, a job she worked for more than a decade and then wrote about in her new memoir, Tell Me Exactly What Happened. Caroline, you write that dispatch is not the place to start a long story. All of the chapters in your book are short, perhaps short enough to read or write between calls. I wondered how you began to write the book and then why you ended up with such sized selections.
I started writing the very first thing I ever wrote about dispatching is the very first chapter of Answering 911. And that is a suicide call that I took in which a woman shot herself. And,
wow.
You know, I'd lived a pretty sheltered life. Up till that point, I had never been so close to such a tragic event, and you know, and obviously immediately after it happened, and so I didn't sleep at all, and I stayed up and wrote about it. And there were many different, you know, there were many different edits that took place after that first chapter was written, but it basically captures how it felt to realize that I was in a job that was probably going to change me in some ways. I don't know how you can talk to a child after something like that, after having seen her mother do something like that, and not feel changed in some way, but strangely untouched, because it didn't affect my life. You know, I didn't have to, I went home to my nice life, you know, but yet I was a different person after that night. And writing has always, like I said, writing has always been a stress reliever. So it felt natural to keep writing.
Hmm. And then the short sections, the chapters of the book, is that to contain individual episodes, or was that coming from a journal of incidents, or you were writing them at work?
I don't think I got a lot of opportunity to write at work, but I did take notes, or I'd email myself or something, and then think about it later. And I think that the chapters are short and largely disconnected, yes, because that kind of mirrors the job itself. I mean, few calls relate to each other. Few calls have anything to do with the others, you know. And it was a little bit different, like for my publisher, my editor, initially when I started writing it and sending her pages, she was like, I don't get where the arc is, or, you know. We were looking for an arc. And I said, I don't know that I can give you one. I would have to make something up, and obviously I'm not doing that, there's no arc. They just go on and on and on. And there have been some arcs in my life, and I describe those. But for the most part, it's just call after call. Mm-hmm. And what do you do with the calls, and how do you deal with them?
So were you known as the writer at the dispatch center? You had uniquely worked with some of the police department when you were working for the newspaper in White Bear.
Yeah. I was known initially by a few of the sergeants who would have to talk to me because I was a reporter. And I say have to talk to me because none of them really wants to talk to reporters. Initially when I got to the first county dispatch center that I worked at, they would joke that, I think she's just here spying on us. She's just writing, she's writing an expose for the newspaper or something. And I was like, I wish I was, because then I'd know there was an endpoint, and it was a really hard first couple of years on that job. And, and then when I got to the ambulance company that I ended up working for 8 years, at that point, my book had been out a couple years, and they would say, someone would say something or do something, and they'd be like, put that in your next book. Or is there going to be a chapter about me in your next book? Which Stella said a lot, and then she got a chapter. So
yeah.
Persistence pays off.
Some of your former dispatchers talked to you about that Answering 911 book. Have any yet talked to you about Tell Me Exactly What Happened?
A few. And so far the reception is good, I tried very hard. So I was critical of one of my former coworkers in the first book. And I didn't get any blowback from that, but I also didn't feel great about it. Because in the end, lucky me, I get to write a book and people read it. She didn't get to write a book. There was no, in the end, it didn't serve. Hmm. And so in the second book, I was very careful. I was the target of my jokes, mm-hmm. period. I think anyway, that I managed not to be critical or very critical of anyone but me. There isn't much to be critical of in the people and the places that I've worked for. I would love to see single dispatch centers, single person dispatch centers go away forever. Mm. I'm critical of that, but mm. But other than that, I'm not, I have no specific critiques on other dispatchers or anything like that.
So, with this group of people who are usually media averse, then if you didn't experience conflicts, I guess, or maybe you gave yourself some boundaries, did you have some cooperation while writing and reflecting about dispatching? Because it's been a bit since you stopped dispatching.
Yeah. I had to... it's funny how quickly you forget things. I had to, ask a few of my coworkers, former coworkers, like, what do we say in that situation again? Like, what, so I had to get some technical things figured out. I had taken some notes on the harder calls, mm-hmm. And actually written You know, a couple things I've in between books, I've written some essays about things. So I had some things to go on. And then, you know, where in the places where my memory failed, I just didn't give those details. I mean, it really doesn't matter if the color was 10 years old or 11 years old, you know? So if I didn't remember, I just didn't say specific age.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty sensitive material. So I'm not sure whether or not you felt like you needed to, or did you ask permission to write about your calls, either from the folks you worked with or your superiors?
Yeah. Mainly, a lot of what I'm talking about at the police departments are now 10 years old. And the important thing about writing about those things is that you make sure that the people involved can't be identified. And so you change details to make sure that that can't happen. And I think I did a decent job of that. There was a feeling. I wanted my readers to understand a feeling of what it was like to respond to some of these calls. The details of where and when and what could be tweaked a little bit to keep that feeling, but not expose people.
Mm. And so it was definitely a different form than journalism to be writing about personal experience, because you do need those 5 W's in journalism.
Yeah, yeah.
So then what were you seeking to write then in the memoir? Was it your personal response, the feeling of that moment?
Yeah. You know, I mentioned a call in the chapter that I talk about the call.
The movie, The Call.
The movie, The Call. I mentioned it in the context of there was one particular call that I got where I felt completely powerless. And I was powerless to help a child, which is the worst feeling that we will go through in that job. Generally, most emergency people will tell you that the calls involving children are the hardest. And, you know, the context of that, it wasn't so important where that call took place or who was shot. It was a child. And what I was trying to relay was, in the movies, this would have turned out different, you know. In the movies, Halle Berry would have saved this child. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't save this child. And what it feels like to feel so impotent and to listen to the most horrifying scene that you could ever think of and only just be able to say, we're almost there, ma'am. We're almost there. We're on the way, you know. It's a hard, hard 5 minutes. And I don't expect, you know, sympathy for that. But again, it's very cathartic to write about it because it's a trauma for that dispatcher in a small way.
And especially as a mother talking to another mother, that yeah. I'm sure it's like you can imagine what if you were the one having to make that call.
Yeah.
Hmm. So you mentioned about that this book is one of the only books about dispatching. Now, granted, there's a lot of maybe medical services books. Did you end up reading other books before writing this, and or do you feel like you've joined a larger community of emergency workers who are writers who have become writers?
Well, you know, the two books that I think of when you say that, that really inspired me and helped me to write my book were Mike Perry, Population 485.
Sure.
He's a volunteer firefighter and obviously has gone on to do a lot more mm-hmm. writing. And then Jane Stern, who usually doesn't write memoir, she wrote a book called Ambulance Girl, which she talks about being a volunteer EMT. And she gets very personal in that book because she entered into that with a terrible fear of illness. Like she was a she was a bit of a hypochondriac, and she had a terrible fear of other people's illnesses. And she kind of made herself do this to see if she could do it, you know? And so those two books were really inspiring and helped me to understand that if you're keeping something from your reader, they will know. Like, because I felt like they very much laid themselves bare for those books and very much let us see into their hearts in those books.
So were you reading those while you were dispatching, after you were dispatching, while you were writing the book?
I would say I've read both of those books a few times, so I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay.
Ongoing.
And you ended up writing Answering 911 while you were a dispatcher. Well, then tell me exactly what happened. Well, you wrote it after you ended dispatching. What was the difference between first writing about something that people didn't know you were going to write about and having this book versus then writing this book after already having written a book about dispatching and writing a follow-up and a second book?
I would say there didn't feel like there was a lot of difference. The main feeling that I felt when I was writing Answering 911 was, you know, I was thinking like a rookie, and everything was, holy crap, you won't believe what just happened, you know?
Uh-huh.
And tell me exactly what happened, I'm able to sit back a little bit from things and be a little more analytical and a little less freaked out, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a big difference between the two books is my tone, probably. I always said, you know, people would ask me if I was going to write another book after the first one. And the thing I said a lot was, well, I think a veteran should write a book now. You know, a rookie wrote a book. I think a veteran should write a book. And then 10 years later, like, no one had written a book. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm kind of, you know, I've
you
been
became
doing
a
this
veteran.
For a while.
I guess
I'll be the veteran in this one, you know.
That's interesting. So dispatchers always want to answer this question, how can I help? But you write that people forget that dispatchers need help too. They're overworked, mm-hmm. underappreciated, sometimes poorly trained. How do you want tell me exactly what happened to help dispatchers?
Well, I'm really proud to say that the first book I can tell from feedback has helped people, has helped dispatchers. I get a lot of notes from dispatchers about, hey, I read the book and thank you. And so I hope that Tell Me Exactly What Happened, you know, continues to do that and is something that a dispatcher and anyone else can read and go, oh, you know, and understand that these are people behind the phone and people who want desperately to do well, want to do the best they can, and sometimes they can, and sometimes they can't.
Well, Caroline, I appreciate you for being a voice of dispatchers, and I thank you for talking to me today.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Caroline Bureau is the author of Tell Me Exactly What Happened. You've been listening to Book Central. I'm Chris Viviora. Our theme music was composed by Will Pett.